versus Craig Shadoff. Arguing on behalf of the Shadoffs is Todd C. Esser. We will then hear from Valerie Bailey-Rinn arguing for the corporation, and then Mr. Esser, you have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
May it please the Court and opposing counsel, my name is Todd Esser. I represent the appellants, Craig and Susan Shadoff. The holding that the Shadoffs request that this Court adopt is that Wisconsin Statute 806.19 sub 4 is clear and unambiguous and should be applied as written. The Shadoffs request that this Court remand this case to the Circuit Court with instructions that the Shadoffs' application be granted and that Meagle's judgment be satisfied. I would like to primarily focus on the issue raised by the Court of Appeals and its certification to this Court regarding federal preemption. I think the facts are fairly straightforward and covered by the briefs. In the Perez case cited by respondent Meagle Development Corporation, I'll refer to as Meagle, the United States Supreme Court teaches us that making this determination is essentially a two-step process. First, we ascertain the construction of the two statutes allegedly in conflict, and second, we determine the constitutional question of whether they are in conflict. In ascertaining the construction of the statute, the Court should look to this statute's primary purpose. With all due respect to opposing counsel, notwithstanding Meagle's transparent arguments to the contrary, the primary purpose and intent of the Wisconsin legislature in drafting 806.19 sub 4 is clear. As described by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals in EPF Corp. v. Faust in 1997, the statute permits a person who has received a bankruptcy discharge to seek a circuit court order satisfying a judgment based on a debt which has been discharged in bankruptcy. As further elaborated by amicus in its brief, the intent of the section is to provide certainty in the title to real estate. There's a strong interest of the state in determination of the property interest of its residents. This has long been recognized that states have the power to provide for the determination of titles to real estate and its borders. In the Zeiss decision, also cited by amicus in its brief, the United States Supreme Court recognized, quote, the state has control over property within its limits, and the condition of ownership of real estate therein, whether the owner be stranger or citizen, is subjugated to its rules concerning the holding, the transfer, liability to obligations, private or public, and the modes of establishing title thereto.
Counsel, let me ask you, you have the homestead exemption. Wisconsin has $40,000 exemption. Now, I know in this case it's you're talking about $30,000 or $40,000 more than that. What if it was a $600,000 home? Do you think that the court should come down the same way, your way? You're talking about it. Basically, you have a federal homestead exemption. With state of Wisconsin, $40,000. Let's say the home was worth, as I said, $500,000 or $600,000. Can you see that happening? Where you're saying the statute is clear, 806.19.4, and would that make sense?
Judge, you have to appreciate, for the most part, homestead exemption laws are applied in a non-bankruptcy context, where our exemption laws govern the relationship between judgment debtors and judgment creditors every day in proceedings that don't involve bankruptcy. 806.19 sub 4 is not an exemption statute. It doesn't have any impact or effect on the amount of the exemption. The exemption is established by state law.
So you think it makes no difference, whatever?
I think it's not relevant to the homestead exemption, Your Honor. I also think that given different factual circumstances, we may have to have different results in the bankruptcy court. For instance, if the homestead was worth substantially more and the judgment wasn't quite as large, the trustee would have administered this asset for the benefit of all creditors in the case. There's no question at that point that the asset would have been sold by the bankruptcy trustee. Claims would have been determined as of the date of filing. Secured claims would have been allowed or disallowed under Section 506A, and distributions would have been made by the trustee. 806.19 never enters into that equation. It has no impact or effect on the bankruptcy proceeding.
Here the trustee abandoned the asset. In other words, they didn't follow through it. But you're saying it wouldn't make any difference because it doesn't affect this particular statute.
It doesn't impact the statute. It doesn't impact the bankruptcy proceeding. That's primarily why there's no federalism involved, because 806.19 has no impact at all on the bankruptcy proceeding, the administration of the case, or any other aspect.
Now, let's just suppose that this property is not homestead property, but is real estate. There is a judgment lien that precedes the petition for bankruptcy, right? Those are the facts of the case, except the homestead issue. And let us suppose, as Justice Wilcox stated, that you have a highly valuable piece of property and a smaller judgment lien, smaller in amount, right? And that the trustee goes ahead and sells it. And let us suppose the judgment lien is perfectly good under Wisconsin law. Would the judgment lien creditor get the first dibs on those assets in bankruptcy law?
In the bankruptcy case, if the trustee chose to administer the asset, then distribution would be made according to the bankruptcy code.
Well, under the bankruptcy code, would the judgment lien get the lien satisfied?
Security interests are generally paid from assets that are administered first.
Right. Okay. So the judgment lien would be good in bankruptcy court?
Yes, it would.
All right. Now the trustee decides he's not going to administer this property, right?
Yes.
And it comes into Wisconsin, and now the debtor wants the lien satisfied, right?
Yes.
So there'd be a different result if the trustee takes the property and the trustee doesn't take the property to administer, as you said it? Because if he doesn't take the property to administer, then you come under, the argument is you come under 806.19.4 and it's gone. The lien's gone. Where have I gone astray?
Well, Judge, I guess the hypothetical is that the trustee wouldn't be interested in administering
right.
this asset.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite
often. It may be only a difference in $5,000 between the lien and the fair market value of the property. So he's not interested. Now is stays in state court and under 806.19, what's the result? Your result is that the lien's gone, isn't it?
Isn't the issue, Judge, whether the trustee chooses to administer the asset?
That's what I'm saying.
Wouldn't a judgment creditor or any other secured creditor perhaps be interested in carving out equity for the unsecured creditors in the bankruptcy case so that the trustee has interest in administering the property?
My question is still the same. Do you get a different result if the trustee administers the assets and when the trustee decides not to administer the assets?
I don't think you've got a different result, Your Honor, because for purposes of the bankruptcy, 806.19 in no way influences the bankruptcy trustee's decision on whether to administer that asset. Now, trustees, for a number of reasons, determine not to administer assets. And a judgment lien under 806.15 is not the only type of lien that flows through bankruptcy. Certainly, we see liens under a number of circumstances that come through bankruptcy, whether it be mortgage liens, liens on vehicles, or other security interests.
Counselor, I'm still not understanding your answer to the Chief's question. I think what she wanted to know is, in one circumstance, does the secured person get paid where the trustee administers the asset? And in the other circumstance, where the trustee chooses not to and the owner of the asset files under 806.19, does the secured party not get paid? I think that was your question. I'm not understanding your answer very well to it.
Okay. Well, if the asset is not administered by the bankruptcy trustee for whatever reason,
right.
There's no question that upon the discharge of the in personam liability, then the judgment debtor is authorized to apply for satisfaction of the judgment. And by operation of the statute, the judgment lien is then terminated.
So the difference in the treatment of the judgment creditor can be nothing more than whether the trustee wants to administer the asset or not.
So that's one of the – certainly one of the factors is whether the trustee administers the property or not. But let's not lose sight of the fact that the judgment creditor could have taken steps in order to either perfect or to realize on their judgment lien before the bankruptcy case started.
Well, they perfected their lien by filing the judgment, didn't they? Otherwise, it wouldn't be a judgment of record.
Consider that in this case, Meagher, for instance, waited 9 years before doing anything. They were certainly on notice because of Wisconsin's over 60 years of history relative to satisfaction of judgment liens post-bankruptcy discharge, that if they sat on their hands relying just on the judicial lien as their sole means of collecting on their judgment, they would do so at their own risk. Meagher now complains that the state has taken away the lien provided by the statute when the judgment was docketed. But wasn't it on notice that the lien could be lost if the debt was discharged in bankruptcy? Couldn't Meagher have availed itself to other collection action during the last 9 years?
Didn't it try to get this judgment recognized in bankruptcy and avoid what's happened here? Didn't it bring a motion in bankruptcy court?
No, Judge. The only activity in bankruptcy court was objection to the debtor's homestead exemption. And that objection was denied.
But the court granted, I thought, Meagher the right to reassert that interest at a later time.
The judge's order was succinct. Judge Shapiro drafted his own order, and he provided that in the event that the Shadoffs petitioned the court under Section 522F of the Bankruptcy Code for avoidance of a judicial lien, that Meagher could raise the same arguments they were trying to raise at that time. I'd like to point out to the court the basis for the court's comments and the reason for the order. In order to understand that, the court has to understand the holding of the United States Supreme Court in the Taylor decision. In Taylor, a bankrupt had made a claim of exemptions that was specious. There was no legal basis for the claim of exemption, but for whatever reason, the trustee in that case didn't object to the debtor's claim within 30 days of the meeting of creditors as required under bankruptcy law. The effect was and the Supreme Court held, that no objection could be raised. Subsequent to Taylor, crafty debtors and their lawyers were making specious types of exemption claims, waiting out the 30-day time limit, trustees generally not objecting because of liens encumbering the property, and then filing the 522F motions and asserting that it was too late to object to the claim of exemption because they hadn't objected timely within the 30-day limit. That essentially is what the Schoonover case is all about. The Schoonover case cited by Meagher in its brief, except that Schoonover said, we're not buying that Taylor argument anymore. We're going to allow lien creditors to raise the defense. We're going to allow them to challenge that exemption when the 522F motion is brought. What Judge Shapiro was doing in his order was saying, look, if you got an argument about the homestead exemption, you can bring that up when a 522F motion is brought. I understand you want to raise the argument. I'm denying it now. If they bring a 522F motion, you're not going to be in a Taylor type of situation. You can bring up those same arguments later on. That's all that was going on with Judge Shapiro in his order.
Does the creditor have a right to bring a 522 motion or just a debtor?
Just the debtor, Your Honor.
I was going to ask you also about the 522 motion. Your opponent would argue, as I understand the briefs, that you were required to bring such a motion before having the advantage of the Wisconsin statute, 19-4. What's your response to that?
Well, Judge, it's clear in the Wisconsin legislature's response in redrafting the statute after the Court of Appeals decision in Vegas, in redrafting the statute after the circuit court's holding an overhead door, that that is not what the legislature intended. They do not intend that there be a motion within the bankruptcy court which avoids the lien as a precondition to the granting of relief under 80619.
Now, your reading of the statute, as I understand it, is that all that is required is that the bankruptcy court basically discharge that judgment or discharge the debt, if you will. Not looking at the lien, but looking at the debt. Is that correct?
That's right, Your Honor. The issue is, was the debt discharged? We all acknowledge that only in personam liabilities are affected. Liens generally pass through bankruptcy, whether they be mortgages or liens on cars or whether they be judgment liens for that matter. The bankruptcy code does not affect those liens unless the debtor happens to take an affirmative action. Now, it's common practice in Wisconsin for the debtors and their counsel not to take affirmative action, as noted by amicus in its brief. There are literally thousands of applications granted routinely, and it is not practice for debtors to file 522F motions in this state. It is superfluous for two reasons. Number one, judgment liens don't encumber the homestead equity by operation of the statute, 81520. So to bring a motion in bankruptcy court under 522F, which states that the lien is avoided to the extent it impairs an exemption to which the debtor would otherwise be entitled, doesn't make any sense. Judge Clavert routinely would deny those motions on that basis when he was on the bench. But in any event, the other factor is that had the debtors brought a 522F motion, Meagle's arguments challenging the homestead exemption would have fallen by the wayside. They weren't relevant. A proper analysis of 522F indicates the analysis is you add up all the liens affecting the property, including the lien to be avoided, add in the debtor's exemption, compare that to the value of the property to the extent that there's any excess, the lien is avoided to that extent. The Judge Shapiro made no determination regarding the valuation of the property, regarding the validity of the lien or otherwise. Those issues were not before the court, and that's why 80619 in no way impairs or affects the bankruptcy proceeding. There is no preemption issue.
Am I correct that many states would treat this situation differently than Wisconsin treats it, at least as you argue that Wisconsin treats it, that some states would provide that there would not be a full satisfaction of the judgment lien if there is indeed equity remaining?
Well, Judge, there's, as we indicated in our briefing in the circuit court, there's a full spectrum of how these matters are treated. And that's in recognition of the fact that that property rights are determined by the states. And each state has a different way of either granting their judgment creditors liens. Some states require that the judgment creditor go out, locate the property, and execute it against the property in order to acquire the lien. Wisconsin's very generous. Wisconsin provides a broad blanket lien. All the judgment creditor need to do is properly docket that judgment in the county where the property is located, and they obtain the lien. So, too, with regard to relief provided to judgment debtors after there's been a discharge of the judgment in bankruptcy. But the point is that where legislatures have intended to include any type of precondition, they're very specific about it. For instance, Oklahoma. Oklahoma has a precondition to granting of this type of relief. They say right in their statute, go and look and see what happened in the bankruptcy proceedings, get us a copy of the order from the bankruptcy court, and to the extent the court avoided the lien, that's what we'll do. Wisconsin doesn't do that.
So if you had a statute in Wisconsin like you have in Oklahoma, then you'd want to bring a 522F motion. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And as I indicated, there's a whole spectrum of different events that take place. As we pointed out in our briefing, Michigan has a statute very similar to Wisconsin's. We believe it would be very similar in application as well.
So it's your position that this lien was not destroyed in the bankruptcy court?
Well, Judge, it's basic bankruptcy law. That liens are not affected by bankruptcy discharge.
All right. So that the lien was not affected in the bankruptcy court. It survived the bankruptcy court.
It did.
But that the statute, 806.19.4, can destroy the lien.
It doesn't destroy the lien, Judge. All it does is it operates to satisfy the judgment of record, and by operation of law, the judgment is no longer lien. And let's,
I like your phrasing better, but the end result is the lien is gone. The creditor loses.
Let's give...
come on now, right?
Judge, as the Supreme Court in this case,
it doesn't mean you lose the case, but it does mean that the lien survives bankruptcy and it doesn't survive the Wisconsin statutes.
Well, let's look at what the lien is, Your Honor. And that is that, as this Court said in Musa v. Sigelke and Kohlhaas Company, that the lien is just a security for a debt. It's not a property interest.
And the debt's gone and the debt was in personam. The lien is in re... in rem, thank you, in rem, and the result is that if it starts out in personam and the debt is, the in personam debt is destroyed in bankruptcy, eliminated in bankruptcy, then the in rem judgment lien fails. I mean, that's your, as I understand your argument, that's it. If you had an in rem judgment and an in rem lien, then you got a different bag. That's
right.
your
I agree. That's what the statute says.
Okay.
I think it's instructive to look at another case pointed out by
Mr. Esser. Before you do that, let me ask you this question. There seems to be a bit of a fairness issue involved in all of this. You've got a situation where your client has a homestead exemption of $40,000. Apparently, the equity remaining after the two mortgages is in excess of that by, if I remember right, it was around $10,000. Meagle is owed money. Why shouldn't we, looking at this in terms of fairness or due process or however you want to characterize it, let Meagle get at that excess?
Well, I think the answer might be, Your Honor, that that's not a function of this Court, with all due respect. It's a function of the legislative process. It's up to the legislature to determine under what circumstances they're going to provide for satisfaction of judgments. They granted that broad right to creditors, and they're the body that should determine under what circumstances they're going to limit or extinguish that broad grant of authority to creditors.
And you think that after Overhead Door and after Biggest that the legislature has clearly spoken. Is that correct?
Judge, I don't think there's any question that after those two cases and viewing the legislature's actions in redacting and amending the statute to take out language that was relied upon by those courts and bringing and bringing the statute back to what they originally intended and what it has been for over 60 years, that they've spoken. That's their intention.
If we buy your argument, don't we de facto increase the homestead exemption to whatever equity there is?
This is not a homestead exemption case. It has nothing to do with exemption law. It is simply the extinguishment of a judgment in the judgment and lien docket.
But the way the issue was phrased for us and the reason we took the case is when there is equity above the homestead exemption. Because if you just had a homestead exemption, you wouldn't be before us. We would never have taken your case. So it would have been all taken care of in bankruptcy court. There would be nothing left for this lien, whatever it is, to attach to. And don't we then increase the homestead exemption if we buy your argument?
Well, Judge, there's other types of property that might be impacted by this. The legislature is clear. They say that the lien, upon satisfaction of the judgment ceases to be a lien on any property owned by the
debtor. Sure, and I appreciate
so it's not a homestead case.
Well, it could be any case.
It could be any property, I agree. We're just focusing on homestead because that's what's at issue here.
Justice Prosser had a question.
The judgment lien, as I understand it, is a property right. When, under due process, was the property right extinguished?
Judge, respectfully, I'd like to take issue with that. This Court stated in 1937 in the Musa v. Sigelki case that a judgment lien is not a property interest. And there is no contrary law or decisions since that case. It does not constitute in law, per se, a property right in the land itself, and a plaintiff who obtains a judgment does not thereby acquire any interest or estate in the property. So it's not a taking of any kind of property interest. There's no grant or guarantee to a lien creditor who goes through the process of a bankruptcy and doesn't have his lien impaired by the bankruptcy process in any way because the asset isn't administered, that the lien is forever galvanized against any type of attack. For instance, if an automobile lien survives bankruptcy, can the creditor then complain that their lien is somehow protected from any type of challenge by a debtor under the Consumer Act? That doesn't follow. The same thing is true with a mortgage. Just because the mortgage passes through bankruptcy I'm sorry, Judge, I'm out of time.
You should answer the question, okay. Please.
Just because the mortgage passes through bankruptcy doesn't mean it isn't subject to any type of challenge by the mortgagor under the Consumer Act or any other provision.
I thought you would say that the judgment lien takes with it 806.19, and the judgment lien, therefore, has a limitation because the judgment lien is set forth in the state statute. So the judgment lien is saying, hey, you got a judgment lien, but if it's discharged in bankruptcy, you don't have a judgment lien. And so you take your, even if you accept it as a property right, you take your property right given by statute with all the statutory limitations.
Judge,
I do like
your answer because the legislature gives the property interest. It certainly has the right to modify or take it away or determine under what circumstances it might be terminated. For instance, 806.
I don't know what the statutes were when this lien was created. Was it the same?
806.15 sub 1 is the statute that creates the lien. Well, it also has a sunset provision in it. It terminates in 10 years. So if the legislature can determine in that circumstance when a lien terminates, what prevents it from, in a related section of 806, from determining other circumstances under which the lien might terminate? It certainly is within the state's rights to do so. As Justice Scalia pointed out in the BFP Resolution Trust Corp case, where there's a strong interest of a state in determining the property interest of its residents before the court will find that federal law impedes or affects that right, there must be a specific federal statute and a very specific federal purpose that requires the action taken. Meagle hasn't provided any specific statute. They suggest that the lien survives the bankruptcy.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Savoli-Ring.
Thank you, Honor. May it please the Court and opposing counsel, my name is Valerie Bailey-Reen. I represent the respondent, Meagle Development Corporation. Seated at counsel's table with me is Patrick Shane of our Milwaukee office, and Michael Shimersky of Meagle is behind us. Before I get into my prepared argument, I would like to address some of the questions that the Court asked. First of all, they asked, well, is the lien valid in bankruptcy? Yes, unless it was obtained in the preference period, which is a 90-day period prior to bankruptcy, which did not occur in this case. A judicial lien is valid in the bankruptcy. It's treated as a security interest, and the trustee is subject to that. Case law is very clear on that. The trustee can't decide to administer property that is fully secured unless it cuts some deal with the secured creditor. So as the same with a mortgage, the trustee takes the bankruptcy property subject to the judicial lien and will not do anything with it. And it will be abandoned back to the debtor upon the order of discharge. There are situations in which, and I'm facing one, where a property has a, it is $400,000 and has a judgment lien in excess against that property. If it's discharged in bankruptcy, and as Shadoff say, 806.19 is automatic, the trustee can't administer that property, but as soon as these people walk out of bankruptcy, they're going to have a $400,000 home free and clear of any lien. So the practical effect of what they're saying is it's going to speed up the process. People are going to have to enforce their lien rights immediately upon them attaching. And normally creditors will wait until the property is sold, figuring a voluntary sale brings the best price. And it's not forcing the people out of their homestead. In addition, the homestead, to foreclose on a homestead with a judicial lien or a judgment lien takes 15 months. It takes a fairly significant period of time. And at the end of the day, at a fire sale, you're going to have a less price than if the creditor waits till it's a voluntary sale, and then they can look to the property to pay off a portion of the judgment. In this case, Meagle did attempt to force the issue by filing a motion to object to the homestead exemption because there was a conflicting line of authorities that said you needed to do that or you lose your right if the debtor later files a 522F motion. So what happens is Meagle did attempt to enforce its rights. It can't file a 522F motion. Only the debtor can do that. And so case law, the In re Schoonover case, is clear. Judgment liens survive the bankruptcy. You don't have to take any affirmative actions as a creditor in bankruptcy. And then upon the bankruptcy discharge, you can take your actions in state court like any other mortgage holder or creditor. So one of the other questions was, is the lien destroyed or somehow gone once a debtor receives a bankruptcy discharge? It's conceded that liens pass through and they're not destroyed. They're not void. If you look at 524A of the Bankruptcy Code, it says the judgment is void to the extent of the personal liability. It's not totally void, only the personal liability. So the lien survived, and the creditor is entitled to look through to that lien just like it looks through a mortgage holder. If the Shadoff's interpretation were correct, any time a note in a mortgage, a person files bankruptcy that has a mortgage, if their note, the personal obligation on the note's discharged, under Wisconsin law, the mortgage is gone, too. And clearly, that's not the case. A note and mortgage, the only thing that's discharged is the personal obligation, and a mortgage holder could still look to their mortgage.
So what's the significance of the Wisconsin legislature, and I can't remember if it's after Bigas or after Overhead Door, but basically the Wisconsin legislature in both instances amending the statute, and in one of those instances, getting rid of the language about void, the bankruptcy court having to find that the judgment is void or the debt is void. Isn't that somewhat significant as we look at all of this?
Yes, and I believe it supports our argument because what they were trying to do is make the statute consistent with the bankruptcy code. In Overhead Door, the judge decided that she could not sign a satisfaction order, actually she vacated it, because the judgment hadn't been declared void in the bankruptcy proceeding. Now, 99% of the, well, first of all, debtors don't get judgments declared void in the bankruptcy proceeding. They get a discharge of their debt. In addition, what she was saying is if she had to read the statute the way she thought it was written, all judgment liens would survive the bankruptcy, whether or not there was any equity to which the judgment lien could attach. Because then they went back to the bankruptcy court in Overhead Door, and Judge Crabb determined that there was no equity over and above the mortgage to which the judgment lien attached. So to me, what that says is 99% of the time, you're going to have the situation in which there's no equity over the homestead exemption and over the mortgages. So the lien never attached. Under Wisconsin law, a judgment lien doesn't attach to the homestead exemption. So the lien never existed. So you get out of bankruptcy, your in persona or your personal obligation to pay a debt is gone, and there wasn't any in rem portion of that judgment that existed because it never attached. So you have a right to have it satisfied. It's a procedure to clear land titles when both parts of the judgment are gone, the personal obligation and the in rem portion because it never attached in the first place. So all Meagle is saying is in the rare circumstances, but they do exist, especially with the value of homes these days, in which the equity in the home exceeds the mortgages in the homestead, they have a right to have that lien flow through the bankruptcy and enforce the lien either in state court or if the debtor chooses to argue the issue in bankruptcy court under 522, that's an alternate way to deal with the issue.
Why shouldn't we look at the action by the legislature twice amending the statute and come to the conclusion that the legislature really intended that if indeed the debt is discharged in bankruptcy, that you can get the judgment lien satisfied by following 806.19.4. Isn't that a reasonable interpretation?
I think there are three problems with that. One, the statute itself provides for several things to be done before you can have the lien satisfied or the judgment satisfied. First, you have to give notice to the creditors of the bankruptcy. For the most part, if creditors don't receive notice in the bankruptcy, the debt isn't discharged. And there's exceptions to that, but that's sort of the general rule. Secondly, you also have to certify that the judgment has been discharged, not the judgment debt, but the judgment. And this change was after Doosnip and the law, so one would assume that the legislator understood that there's a difference between a judgment and a judgment debt. Secondly, it also talks about certifying that the debt was discharged. So there are certain circumstances I think a creditor can come in and object. It's not automatic. If you have this application, the judge doesn't have to sign the application. There's nothing in the statute that requires that automatic.
Counsel, what is your understanding of the difference between a judgment and a judgment debt?
Okay. The judgment debt is the in persona or the personal obligation. A judgment has two aspects. I think it has both the personal obligation and also the in rem if the judgment lien has attached.
And how do you square your argument with the language of 4A that says any person who has secured a discharge of a judgment debt in bankruptcy? They're not talking about judgment. They're talking about judgment debt.
Right. But they're saying anybody who's secured a discharge of judgment debt may apply to the court for an application. So, correct, when you go through a bankruptcy proceeding, you get a discharge of your debts. You don't get a determination that the judgments are, quote, void. That was the outdoor overhead door case. But then if you look at the application area, what you have to certify in the application, which I believe is in subsection B, it doesn't say judgment debt. It says that you have to certify that the judgment has been discharged in bankruptcy. So it's a procedure by which people that do get a bankruptcy discharge of their debts can come in and say not only is the debt discharged, but also the in rem aspect has been discharged either under 522F or it never existed, never attached, because there wasn't any equity to which the homestead exemption could attach.
Isn't your argument about this dual aspect, that there are in rem aspects and that there are in personam aspects, wasn't that shot down by the court in Spore, the very argument you're making?
Your Honor, that was before Dewstep. It was also before Johnson, and it was two Supreme Court cases, Johnson versus Homestake, and it was also before In re Schoonover, which specifically dealt with judgment liens. In that case, it was a question whether exempt money was exempt in an account to which a judgment lien had it attached.
Would we have to overrule that language in Spore that says, listen, the creditor is making these arguments about in personam aspect and in rem aspect, and we disagree that's incorrect. The term in rem and in personam describe actions, not aspects. Do we have to overrule Spore?
No, because I believe the U.S.
Could.
Yeah, it's a bankruptcy court decision
right.
for
yeah.
Judge Usher.
Right. But would we have to disagree and take issue and say that the Spore is incorrect in its conclusion?
I think you would because it was decided before Dewstep. And so Dewstep, the United Supreme Court has already said, Judge Usher, unfortunately, you're wrong on this one point, that there are an in rem and in persona. And there is other Wisconsin case law that are consistent. The other question was, is this a homestead exemption case? 80619 doesn't apply to just homesteads. It applies to commercial property. So you could have a situation, which I think is even more troubling, where a person has a judicial lien on a commercial piece of property owned by an individual. The lien survives the bankruptcy. The trustee can't do anything because the property's subject to a valid lien, just like a mortgage. And then they walk out, they go in and say, it's automatic, Judge, you must sign this order discharging this lien. And they have a valuable piece of property that is completely exempt. Why should the Shadoffs have a better result than any other person? If they weren't in bankruptcy, they have certain exemptions that they're entitled to under the exemption statutes, and it specifically provides for partial lien attaching if it's partially exempt. You carve out the homestead exemption, and then the creditor receives the remainder. So any person not in bankruptcy would be subject to our lien. Any person in bankruptcy, to the extent that we made a deal with the trustee, would be subject to our lien. Or even worse, the trustee has his hands tied, but he should have been able to utilize that value for unsecured creditors.
I don't recall counsel about Dewstep, but I recall about Johnson, and these are the two cases that you say supersedes for.
Right.
But Johnson involved a mortgage.
Right.
Did Dewstep involve a mortgage also?
It was a deed of trust, Your Honor.
Okay, but essentially, I mean, isn't that very different property interest when you're talking about a mortgage interest rather than a lien that arises from an in personam judgment?
No, because In re Schoonover, which is a Seventh Circuit case, which again would overrule Judge Etch's decision, dealt with a judgment lien. But if you look at the order of discharge itself on the back, it says some liens flow through the bankruptcy, including mortgages or security interest, and a judgment lien is valid. It is treated as if it was a mortgage. One thing I wanted to say is if we had an automatic satisfaction in this situation, you do run in against the bankruptcy code's two main purposes, to provide people with a fresh start in life, but not a head start, and also to take all non-exempt assets that are available and distribute them to creditors. And if you interpret the statute the way the Shadoffs are interpreting it, you're going to frustrate those purposes because assets that should have been used to pay creditors are not going to be used to pay creditors. And exemptions are a creature of the statute. They can change them, but under 990.10, if they do that, if a judgment lien's attached, it is effective for the lesser amount. In other words, as the legislator attempted to increase the homestead to $60,000, the judgment lien that attaches is still effective to the on that property. So there are some due process issues here. The satisfaction order, if entered automatically without any chance of Nego being able to contest it, I think, would be an unconstitutional taking. As far as judgment liens being only effective for 10 years, that's by statute. People have noticed, they understand how the statute works. And I'm saying only when you have it in the context of a bankruptcy is there a preemption issue. If you interpret it the way Shadoffs do, I think you really do have a preemption issue because it's automatic.
You know, doesn't the, excuse me, doesn't the fact that you have so many different states treating this issue differently argue that this is not a preemption situation? Where is the federal law that you can cite us to that would indicate that this is a preemption issue where you've got the variety that we see from state to state on these matters?
Well, I think if you look at every other state, Your Honor, in every one of those states, they don't give debtors rights that are greater than what they have in the bankruptcy. So I think what you see is those statutes are consistent with the bankruptcy code, so you don't have the preemption arguments. A few cases, statutes, or so that's why I don't think you have the issue. It's because in all those states, they give people coming out of bankruptcy the same rights as they had in bankruptcy. And more importantly, if you interpret it the way that we're saying you should interpret the statute, it's consistent with the bankruptcy code. What it does is it's a mechanism to clear title. If the lien doesn't survive because it never attached or if it was avoided under 522F, it's a way to clear title, as Judge Eilenfeld said in his letter. So most of the time, there's not even any issue that the lien survived. So I don't think there is a preemption. You know, the states have these because they do provide a valid mechanism to clear title. And they're not preempted if that's the purpose of them. Only when they give rights different than what flows through the bankruptcy is there a problem.
Do you have any cases that you can cite that would tell us that if you have a statute like it's argued Wisconsin has, that the federal law has preempted in that area with the bankruptcy code?
I think the closest cases are the statute out of the Ninth Circuit that talked about the exemptions, and that is, I can have that cite for you. It's In re Cantor, 405 F. 2nd, 228. And Perez versus Campbell, a U.S. Supreme Court case, I think is also important. In that case, there was
Excuse me, can I interrupt you? I didn't get the cite. 405 Fed 2nd, what's the page?
405 F. 2nd, 228.
Thank you very much.
And Perez versus Campbell is 402 U.S. 637.
Thank you very much.
What do those cases say?
In re Cantor, the case says there was a section in the statute that said personal injury judgments can be attached and reached by creditors, but they could not be assigned by operation of law. And the Ninth Circuit said that courts have the right to create exemptions. They have a right to change exemptions, but they don't have the right to have exemptions that only apply in bankruptcy proceedings, which is what that statute was attempting to do, because it interfered with the trustee's ability to reach assets for creditors. In Perez versus Campbell, it was the Arizona Motor Vehicle Responsibility Act. What this statute said is you come out of bankruptcy, you get a discharge of a personal injury debt, doesn't matter. We're not going to let you have a driver's license until you pay off that debt. And the court said there was a good reason for the rule. They wanted safe people driving in Arizona, but it didn't matter because it interfered with the bankruptcy's fresh start aspects. And it only applied in the bankruptcy context. So even though driving is a privilege, not a right, and you can have people not get driver's license for a number of reasons, you just can't have the only reason because of the bankruptcy.
Counsel, this is an in personam judgment.
Correct.
And in personam judgments can be discharged in bankruptcy. Correct. I note in the legislative history, and I'm looking at appendix page 36, it's a letter to Senator Brian Rood. It's in the amicus brief appendix. And the amicus is from Wisconsin Land Title Association. And, of course, they advocate the position of your opposing counsel also. And they wrote a letter back in 1994 to Senator Rood's office. And they make the very point as my first exclamation in my comment. At the end of the letter, signed by Peter Christensen, written on behalf of the Wisconsin Land Title Association, that is, they're both members of the Wisconsin Land Title Association, and they want the amendment because we need some changes in the law, and Senator Rood is apparently going to assist you. And Christensen says, look, this is absurd result. If the debtor is relieved of personal liability to the judgment creditor by virtue of the bankruptcy proceeding, so should the judgment creditor's lien against the debtor's property be extinguished. And before that, he says, this is an in personam judgment. We're not talking about an in rem judgment. We're talking about an in personam judgment. You know, I read this amicus, and it was rather persuasive to me. That is, that because you can't confuse, this is an in personam judgment, and it looks like this is what the legislature intended in response to Wisconsin Land Title Association's request for an amendment.
With all due honor to my co-partner, Pete Christensen, I think if you read this letter, he's addressing the situation in overhead door where there wasn't any equity to which the judgment lien would attach. So he's saying it doesn't make any sense that you have a judgment that the personal aspects of it has been discharged, and the in rem aspects have been discharged as well because they never attached, there was no equity, but you couldn't get rid of it because the way that statute was worded, they had to have a judgment that the judgment was declared void in the bankruptcy, and that didn't occur. So what the previous statute was doing was making every single judgment lien flow through, even if the personal obligation was gone, even if there was no equity to which the judgment lien attached, just because the debtor didn't go and ask the bankruptcy court for a declaration that the judgment is void. We're not saying people have to do anything in the bankruptcy to get rid of the liens that are clearly don't attach and they never did attach. We're saying that if they want to go in after bankruptcy and say, you know, we've got a discharge of our debt, the in rem portion of the judgment never existed because it never attached, and therefore we want this judgment lien off our title, we think that's appropriate. We think that the creditors won't object because they know that that's the law. Only in a rare circumstance in which there are some issues that are worth addressing, that there's equity that survived, the debt is non-dischargeable, or the creditor for some reason didn't give notice of the bankruptcy.
I looked at this when Justice Bradley mentioned this, and I see on page 37 in the appendix that Christensen says that bankruptcy law permits the debtor to protect the first $40,000, so he mentions that, of his or her assets from attachment of judgment liens, but not from mortgages, tax liens, and other secured interests set forth in the law. Then he goes on to say, in this case, the value less the federal tax lien and the outstanding mortgage was less than $40,000. So I think that's why I raised, we're coming back to the issue I raised with opposing counsel about when you get up, I realize that this is not that much over 40, but if you, and you talked about, when you're talking about 100,000 or 200,000, it seems, and Justice Crooks alluded to this, just the, quote, public policy or the fairness of that, of allowing that to escape and go back to the hands of the debtor.
Right, and I think that if you interpret this as automatic to allow this to happen, it does run afoul of the bankruptcy code, and the purpose is to provide people with fresh starts, not head starts. And that's why it does allow for Wisconsin's exemptions. Every state can make their own exemption statutes. Wisconsin has said 40,000. Why should a non-bankruptcy judgment debtor have a worse result than somebody who goes through bankruptcy? What it may do is encourage people to change non-exempt assets into exempt assets. If you've got a judgment lien against your property, but you have mortgages and you have any ability to pay down those mortgages, you could use that money to pay down the mortgages, realizing the trustees' hands are tied, there's nothing they can do, and then once they're out of bankruptcy, attempt to get the automatic satisfaction and walk away with that property. And I think that that is an issue. The other problem I see is creditors are going to be cutting deals with trustees to try to get relief from stay, go into state court, file, attempt to foreclose on the judgment lien, delay the discharge because they're going to have to do that with fear that the debtor will get a discharge. And that delays the debtor's fresh start, too, because it's bankruptcy proceedings in Chapter 7 are relatively quick. They go fast, and people get a discharge, and they get on with their lives. But in this case, I think it's going to tie up the bankruptcy proceedings if you interpret it as an automatic. And that's all we're saying. We're not saying that most of the time you can't – the debtor does nothing in a bankruptcy and is entitled to a satisfaction order. We're just saying in the very few situations in which there's some equity, we should have a ability to have our liens remain solid and secure.
But what about the argument that your opposing counsel made? Well, here your client sat on his hands for 9 years. Now, it's obvious that if real estate prices are rising, you would want to, and it's worth, you know, houses have been going up. And but what about his argument that you just sat on your hands and did nothing?
Well, a couple things. I think the statute allows us to do that. I think the reason why is that because it's a lengthy process to foreclose. It's 15 months. And in this situation, you're looking to the value of the house for your debt, and you want to get the more the house is worth, the more likely you're going to get some of your debt paid off. And if you do a foreclosure sale, you're never going to get the value if somebody wants to voluntarily refinance or sell their house. So I think it makes sense for the creditor to wait. Once the debtor sells the house at a fair market value instead of a foreclosure sale, you know, the creditor gets paid, the debtor gets their homestead, because they're always only entitled to the $40,000.
Counsel, we're talking about what makes sense, and from the first get-go when I was reading this case, I had the idea of fairness, you know, swimming around in the back of my mind. But let's look at the statute, because that's what this case is about, isn't it? Statutory interpretation. And let's look at 806-19-4-D. Okay? That's what we're here for. Not what seems fair to me. You know, I might disagree with what the legislature did. I would have balanced the equities differently. But let's see what they did. They say in the statute, this is how it works. Upon receipt, and I'm reading now sub D, which is the relevant statute in question. Upon receipt of a completed application, that is an application for discharge, the clerk shall submit the attached proposed order for signature by a judge, after which the clerk shall satisfy of record each judgment described in the application. Upon satisfaction, a judgment shall cease to be a lien on any real property that the person discharged in bankruptcy owns or later acquires. Now, are you interpreting sub D somewhere? There's language in there that although it says the clerk shall submit the attached proposed order for signature of a judge, after which the clerk shall satisfy the record of each judgment, and as a result, the lien. Are you inserting in there someplace parentheses, but the judge doesn't have to sign parentheses? That's what you're adding in there.
Correct, because it doesn't say anything about the judge. It doesn't say the judge shall sign it.
So in order for your interpretation to be correct, there has to be that in parenthetical, because you have the clerk shall give it to the judge, and after she gives it to the judge, she shall satisfy the record. And you're suggesting that even though it says shall and shall, because it doesn't mention the judge, that the judge doesn't have to sign it.
Yes, because why else would you be required, the creditor, to get 5 days' notice? And also, under the State versus Holmes, I think if the legislator is mandating a judge signing an order without any discretion, you run afoul of the role of the judiciary as well.
I just have one question. You emphasized that it wouldn't be fair to have a mortgage defeated, mortgage lien defeated. You can distinguish a mortgage lien and a judgment lien, though.
Correct. But what I was saying is that no one is going to argue that a mortgage, that the personal obligation is discharged in bankruptcy. And under Wisconsin law, it's clear if the debt's gone, the mortgage is gone. No one's going to come into this court or a bankruptcy court and say, well, the mortgage is gone, so you know, the debt's gone, now the mortgage is gone, too. Thank you, Your Honor.
Here's Chief
Justice Prosser.
If a judgment lien is not a property interest, how would you characterize it?
I think it is a property interest. I think it's subject to regulation, but I think it's a property interest, and I think it's if you aren't allowed to object to the taking of the property interest, you are violating due process. And in here, if it's automatic, you are. You're losing your interest without being able to have a notice and an opportunity to hear.
Well, under bankruptcy law, the lien, under certain procedures, 522, could be discharged. But we're not operating under bankruptcy law. We're operating under state law. So what is the due process right that the judgment lien holder has, if any, in the discharge of the lien, judgment lien?
I think if they have a right to object and say that their lien flowed through and it hasn't been discharged, then I do think they have they've had notice and opportunity and it isn't taken away from them. But if it's automatic and they have a judgment lien and it's automatically satisfied or discharged, I do think that they do have a due process issue.
We had two due process issues, one procedural. So they got notice, you're saying, okay, but you still have a substantive due process, which is you can't take away the property, even if you give all the notice in the world,
right,
without paying for it, or that you have an overriding state interest that you can do it without paying for it,
right,
in some fashion.
And I think having a right, I mean, the lien attached, there's nothing in the state statutes that say if the judgment's gone, you know, the lien doesn't attach. I mean, there's nothing that says if the judgment's void, the lien's void.
Well, that depends on how you interpret 806.19. Your opponent interprets it otherwise, relating that it only relates to in rem judgments and in rem liens, and not in personam judgments and in rem liens. I understand this argument. You don't accept that distinction, if I understand your argument.
Correct, I think.
Justice Bradley read from, 806.19.4d, I think it is.
Correct.
Upon satisfaction, a judgment shall cease to be a lien on any real property that the person discharged in bankruptcy owns or later acquires. But isn't that language subsequent to the time that you obtained the judgment lien?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand your question.
Didn't that come in either 1995 or 1997? And you obtained the judgment lien in 1994?
Yes, you're correct. This language, the current language of the statute, did come into effect after we were operating probably under the language that the overhead door had. And I, frankly, to be honest with Your Honor, we did not focus on that issue. Thank you,
counsel. Mr. Esser?
Thank you, Your Honor. Prior to being revised in 1995 by Act 393, subsection 4B3 read, the undersigned believes that each judgment listed above has been completely voided by the discharge in bankruptcy. That language was modified by the legislature. The words completely voided by the discharge were taken out, and the word discharged in the past tense was inserted.
You think that matters?
I think it's important because I think it's relevant to counsel's argument today. Counsel focuses their argument on that section of the statute. They ignore 806.19 sub 4 sub D sub 1, which focuses and directs the action of the court based on discharge of a judgment debt. And they attempt to read back in the requirement of avoiding the lien. And they call it, instead of avoided, they call it discharged. And those are two very separate terms in bankruptcy parlance. Debts are discharged. Liens are avoided. We don't discharge liens. And to create this confusion between the two terms supports their argument. But once you ferret out how bankruptcy actually functions, it becomes the legislature's intent in drafting the statute and redrafting it, and a third time redrafting it, becomes clear.
Does it cover a mortgage? If this were a mortgage lien, not a judgment lien, would it be void?
No, it in no way impacts or affects any type of mortgage debt because it's a consensual lien on property, Your Honor. A mortgage is a consensual lien.
Where does it say anything about consensual liens?
The statute does not make any reference to consensual liens. It talks about a judgment lien. It talks about recording the satisfaction on the lien docket. It talks about 806.15 is supported by 806.21. With statutes that say when a satisfaction is recorded, then the lien, the judgment lien, is deemed satisfied. Or I should turn that around and say it the other way. When a judgment or a satisfaction of judgment is recorded, then the lien ceases to operate. Focus was made on the apparent or the alleged conflict between 806.19 and federal bankruptcy law. And citation was made to the Cantor decision, and citation's been made to the Cross decision. Each of those cases involved a state statute that prevented the trustee from administering an asset for the benefit of creditors. In the Cantor decision, the state statute with regard to personal injury action, the court noted that it operated to deny a bankruptcy trustee assets which would ordinarily be reached in satisfying the claims of general creditors and thus is invalid under the Supremacy Clause. In the Cross decision, there was an Indiana statute involving an exemption of a tenancy by the entireties in the event that one of the spouses filed bankruptcy. It only operated in the context of a bankruptcy. It was not applicable in a non-bankruptcy circumstance. And the bankruptcy court, after a very thorough review of preemption issues, determined that where that statute only operated in the context of the bankruptcy, preventing the bankruptcy trustee from reaching assets that would have otherwise been available to general unsecured creditors outside of bankruptcy, there was a preemption issue. That is not the case with 806.19. There is no preemption issue. It does not operate in the bankruptcy case. It has no impact on what assets the bankruptcy trustee can reach, nor does it impact or change the effect of the bankruptcy. There is no affirmative order in a bankruptcy case that a judgment lien survives bankruptcy. There is no statute that counsel can point to that says our judgment lien is protected and will never be subject to challenge or modification or change by the state legislature in Wisconsin. The fact that a judgment lien or a mortgage lien or a lien on a car or other security interest flows through a bankruptcy is a byproduct of the bankruptcy process. It is not a determination by the bankruptcy court of the validity of the lien.
Counselor, could I draw your attention back to the statute and an argument that was made by opposing counsel? I don't know if you have the statutes handy, but I'm looking at 806.19, sub 4, B 3.
Judge,
do you have it handy?
I do have it available, Your Honor.
All right. The argument that was made is that in order to get this relief under the statute, you have to make certain certifications in the application. And one of the certifications that you had to make was that each judgment listed above had been discharged in bankruptcy. Now, the judgment is just the personal liability that's discharged in bankruptcy. And her argument was you'd have to certify that either, A, there was never any equity for this judgment to attach to, so we're not going to argue about it, or you had some type of a hearing in bankruptcy court that relieved you of the effect of a lien as well as the personal debt. Could you respond to that, please?
I can, Your Honor. It's just part of the subterfuge, again, with respect to counsel, that counsel has been required to make in order to give any type of support to their argument. They attempt to read in the word avoided for the word discharge.
Focused on judgment rather than judgment debt. I think that was the import of her argument, because her argument says there are two parts to a judgment, a lien and a personal liability. And she says part of the statute, as you begin, talks about a judgment debt, but doesn't, but the this part of the statute, the application, talks about the judgment in its entirety.
Let's first observe that the section that she's relating to is a form that's suggested. It's an illustration, and it says that the application order shall be insubstantially the following form. It is not required language, and it's not the substantive law of the statute. So she makes her argument based on this illustrated form. Also, I'd like to point out that that form was amended at the same time that the substantive part of the statute was amended. And the words that were taken out, as I pointed out, were the words...
I think you said
completely voided by the discharge. Again, the legislature making clear that it wasn't its intention to have the judgment voided in any way. It took those words out. It said, no, we don't want you don't have to prove that the judgment was somehow voided. All you have to show is that the judgment debt was discharged. So the statute is clear with regard to that issue. The legislature's intent is clear with regard to that issue. To read back in something that requirement is contrary to the legislative history and the fact that the legislature has sought to amend the statute to write back out those requirements every time a court has attempted to read those requirements back into the statute. This court should give weight to that type of modification of a statute. As held in Verdolak versus Mosinee Paper, when a statute has been repealed and recreated on the same subject, any changes in its language are presumed to be the result of conscious deliberation on the part of the legislature. The nature and language of legislative amendments are significant, and the omission of a word or phrase is indicative of an intent to alter statutory meaning. So I'm out of time, Your Honor.
So which one, what statute applies here? The statute has been amended. Which one applies here?
Judge, the statute that's applicable is the statute that came into the effect when the discharge occurred. There's certainly nothing in the statute that suggests that it has any basis. And besides that, Your Honor, the legislature made its intent clear that the avoided language wasn't intended to be read the way that the court was reading that avoided language. So that was even a misinterpretation of the statute. So regardless of which statute, the outcome's the same.
Your position is not necessarily the statute that was in effect when the judgment lien came into effect, namely when it was filed.
That's our position, Your Honor. But my point is, regardless, you get the same result.
Under either statute?
Under either statute.
The latest one or the one before that? The result?
The one before that, quite honestly, Your Honor.
It's the same because court has misconstrued the statute. The legislature continually revised it until we would get it right.
That's our position, Your Honor.
And getting it right is holding for your client in this case.
In this case, it is. And
amicus
has made that clear in its brief as well.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes our hearing in 04-AP-1594-FT. Magle Development Corporation versus Shattuck. I wanted to thank both counsel for their briefs and their argument in this case on the interplay of the Wisconsin statutes and the bankruptcy law and statutory interpretation. And Mr. Esser heard my discussion of that as being a continuing issue in this court. Student asked what issues are always before the court, and I said statutory and other language interpretation. So thank you all, and we are in recess. The court will reconvene at 3:10 in the conference room.
3:20. 3:10.